You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a girls' rock camp in Madison that teaches young girls to rock out and build some self-esteem along the way. First, it's National Drinking Water Week. The State Department of Natural Resources announced last week that it will give new grants for low-income areas to replace lead pipes that supply water to homes. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan has drawn a lot of national attention to the dangers of lead in drinking water. And according to a Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism report, at least 176,000 homes and businesses in the state get water from lead service lines. Dee Hall joins us now. She's been reporting on the new grants from the DNR. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me today.
So what happens with this new grant? What exactly will it do?
Well, it tackles a problem that a lot of communities have, which is essentially that they get some federal funding for water improvement projects, but a part of the lead problem is on private property. So these are called lead service lines, and they go from the middle of the street to the house, to the curb, and then the part that goes from the curb to the house is actually owned by the homeowner. This allows these government funds to be used for lower income areas to replace the lead pipes that are actually on private property.
As I understand it from previous reporting by the Center for Investigative Journalism, if you only replace the lead pipes up to a point and the rest is still lead, it could actually make things worse.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that happen when that is done, and I think the policymakers are now starting to pay attention to what the researchers have been telling them for years, which is there's a chemical reaction that can happen between a new copper pipe and an old lead pipe, and also just the disturbance of replacing part of the pipe can knock loose some dangerous chunks of lead.
How much does it cost usually to replace the consumer-owned side of that lead pipe intake?
Well, the DNR is estimating that it's about $3,000 per home. So this $11.8 million isn't going to go super far compared to, you know, in knocking down the issue of having 176,000 lead service lines, but it is considered to be a start.
And who will be eligible to get these kind of grants?
The communities, utilities that are often run by communities will apply for them. There's some criteria. They're trying to focus these grants on communities with lower income, higher unemployment, and to get at places where people are unlikely to have enough, you know, money to replace these on their own.
Talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at lead pipes and Wisconsin water, a new grant from the DNR aimed at helping people, especially in low-income areas, replace lead lines that they're getting their drinking water from. Dee, a graphic from the center showed where we have a lot of these lead water intakes. And they're really concentrated in some parts of the state. Where do we see a lot of this?
Right. So the 176,000 number, which comes from the EPA, is a very rough estimate. The truth is a lot of utilities don't even know if they have lead service lines. So this is a baseline. But of those known 176,000 lead service lines, 70,000 of them are in Milwaukee. So Milwaukee is definitely an epicenter of the issue here in Wisconsin.
Oh, so obviously a high population place. So in some ways, that's no surprise. But also, I imagine a lot of an older water infrastructure.
Right,
there.
And that's the big thing. I mean, homes built after the 50s or so, 50s or 60s, did not have lead service lines. But you do also get a contribution of lead in the water when you have certain connectors between pipes. Some of those were made of lead. You also had lead soldering between that were used to join pipes. So there is lead in some plumbing that is much newer than that.
So of the top five states with these lead water service lines, Milwaukee County, you mentioned, Racine and Kenosha County, I imagine a similar story there. I also saw Marathon County and I think Manitowoc County on that top five list, which surprised me a little more, not the highest population centers in the state.
Well, I think what's happened is at various points, the people who were selling lead lines, you know, had more market penetration in these areas. You know, I think that I've read that there was a pretty successful marketing strategy to keep lead in infrastructure that was particularly successful in the upper Midwest, which is unfortunately now what we're having to replace.
One county not on that list is Dane County, and Madison has, I think, been the first in the nation to try to completely eliminate these lead water lines. What happened in Madison?
Well, this happened over 12 years ago. It actually started probably in the early 90s when they started having lead showing up in their tests. And they explored the variety of options, and it turned out that for Madison, they just felt like getting rid of the pipes was the best solution. action. One way that communities do mitigate this is using corrosion control, which are chemicals that go in the water to try to keep the pipes from corroding. The problem is there's a lot of phosphorus in that. And as you know, phosphorus creates these big algae blooms and horrible conditions, too, which our lakes are already in bad enough shape. So Madison just decided to really bite the bullet and, you know, replace all of the lead service lines in town.
Let's talk about lead water testing. And I know whether we're talking about wells or municipal water supplies, it sounds like a lot of experts think we don't test enough for the water we're actually drinking. What's the state of lead testing and surveying lead in our water in Wisconsin?
Well, the lead and copper rule, which is what governs all testing requirements, really does not require that very many homes be tested at all. For example, Milwaukee only has to test 50 buildings every third year. So obviously that's a tiny fraction of the 70,000 lead service lines there. So that, you know, those rules are being looked at again, but they haven't been updated. So communities that are meeting the lead and copper rule requirements probably aren't testing very many homes, and they don't have to test them very often.
Can you talk some about what's at stake? And I've talked to you about this before. What is the damage being done by lead in water?
Well, the primary concern is for very young children. It really affects their brain development, everything from behavior problems to lower IQ to later criminality have all been tied to the presence of lead in a person's blood. In addition, miscarriages are also a danger for pregnant women who drink water that has too much lead in it.
Getting back to this DNR grant, how does this end up being coordinated between the DNR, the federal funding, the utilities, and then the actual consumers?
Well, in this case, what will happen is the utilities themselves will be the ones that are doing the projects or bidding out the projects to be done, and the DNR is taking the federal funding and for the municipalities that apply, giving it to them. But the individual homeowner is not going to have to contact a contractor or anything. This will really, the utilities will be in charge of these replacement programs.
And you mentioned there's a lot of these lead service lines in Wisconsin's homes and businesses, for that matter. How big a difference will this grant make?
It's relatively small. You know, it's several hundred lead service lines in some communities. But, you know, I think the thing we did talk with a local person who's dealt with this issue in Madison to try to and with other communities helping them solve their lead problems. And she said that what it helps is get over this barrier of the private and public property issues. And it kind of crosses that barrier, which has been a real barrier, not just cost, but this issue of private property. So in that way, it may be a little bit symbolic, but it might show the way for how we can break that barrier down and get these lead pipes replaced, both the private and the public portions.
And do you know of anything else in the works from utilities, local, state government, federal government to try to do more than this grant does?
Well, for one thing, this grant, if successful, would be extended for the next year as well. So they've already decided that. On the national level, they're still looking at the lead and copper rule. The ultimate goal of the proposed changes to the lead and copper rule are to replace all lead service lines, period. Of course, that is a monumental, gigantic task. Milwaukee has estimated it costs $500 million, half a billion with a B, dollars, to replace all of the lead service lines in that town.
Dee, thanks a lot for joining us again.
All right, thank you.
That's Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about new grants from the Wisconsin DNR to replace lead pipes bringing water into homes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll look at the ongoing political fight over closing Guantanamo Bay's detention center, and we'll hear about a Wisconsin National Guard unit that's preparing to deploy there. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. The Shawamigan Symphony Orchestra recently celebrated 50 years of performing in northwestern Wisconsin. The orchestra has tied community members and generations together over the years through a shared love of music. WPR's Danielle Kading has more.
Ashland teen Aaron Thornton's interest in music started with listening to his dad play trumpet.
I always sit in the kitchen and listen. I would bug my dad, be like, can I blow a note into it?
Music is a family affair for Aaron, his younger brother, and his dad. All three play an instrument in the Shawamigan Symphony Orchestra. Father Trevor Thornton says his son Tyler fell in love with the clarinet at a young age.
One day he says, "Hey, Dad, when am I going to get to play the clarinet?" And I says, "Well, okay, Tyler, you know, I think it was the summer after he finished first grade, he got it. And he tried to play it. Air was coming out of everywhere but the instrument. And he stuck to it, tried. Finally, he got a note. It came out, and then he got excited. Oh, you know, see, I can do this."
13-year-old Tyler Thornton says playing the clarinet just looked really fun, and so did playing with the orchestra.
"It gives me the opportunity to play with a full group that most people at my age don't get. It's good practice to be able to play exactly with the group."
Orchestra conductor and Northland College music professor Joel Glickman says he welcomes talent from musicians of all ages and backgrounds.
"There's a practical aspect of that. Ashland is not the most populous place in the world. We tend to need people from all age groups to reach the proper size and variety for ensembles. And so when there are younger players that are ready for what we're doing, it just makes sense. But on the other hand, it's not a chore. The spirit of cooperation and the spirit of mentorship from more seasoned players and adults, and it's just been the great fun about being the conductor."
Proud father Trevor Thornton says the diversity of players is what makes the Shawamigan Symphony Orchestra unique.
"Having much older players sitting right next to very, very young players, and then the Northland College students who come from all over the country, everybody brings their experience onto the stage. It does make for a different experience."
Leslie Colasar of Saxon agrees.
"The older members are really proud of the fact that we're a training orchestra and we want to share our love of music with the generation that's coming up."
This is Colasar's 25th season playing the flute with the Shawamigan Symphony Orchestra, and she says it never gets old.
"I love the people best. I love where I sit. I'm right in the middle of everything. I've got the clarinets behind me and the oboes to the left and the strings in front and the low brass behind me, and I love being right in the middle and in the center of everything."
Glickman says there's something special about the orchestra that he hasn't experienced elsewhere in his more than 40 years of conducting.
"There is this thing, you know, I'll just evoke the French, it's got that certain je ne sais quoi, I don't know what it is."
Whatever it is, one thing is clear. The Shawamigan Symphony Orchestra's shared love of music spans all ages, setting the stage for the next generation of musicians like Tyler and Aaron to share that love with players and audiences for many more years to come.
Danielle Kading brought us that story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org. From classical music, we turn up the volume a few notches and look at a phenomenon picking up steam around the country, children's rock camps. Over the past few years, we've seen these spring up here in Wisconsin, and the one in Madison focuses specifically on teaching girls how to rock out. Just heard some of those campers singing the Girls Rock Camp theme song in the program's studio. Joining us now to tell us more about Girls Rock Camp, we have Beth Killey, music director at Girls Rock Camp Madison. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us how this came about, the idea behind these kids' rock camps and the Girls Rock Camp in particular.
Yes. Well, Girls Rock Camps exist all over the country. In fact, all over the world now. But there was a parent who approached me several years back who wanted to get his daughter into a Girls Rock Camp in Chicago and kept getting put on the waiting list. And he said, "You should start up a camp like this here in Madison." And I said, "Oh, that sounds like a great idea." So partnered up with Hallie Paulet, who is now our executive director. Mm-hmm. And she was actually trying to get one started, too, because she had been trying to get her daughter into the Chicago camp and wasn't able to, and thought, well, I'll just start one up myself. So we worked together and got the first one off the ground here in Madison in 2010. We had 32 girls at that camp.
Wow.
And It has blown up over the last 7 years. Well, this will be our seventh summer that we're doing the camps. So we'll have about 150 girls coming through three different sessions this summer. And it's just been a blast.
What's the age range?
The campers are ages 8 to 18. And they don't have any musical experience when they show up. We provide all the instruments. We teach them how to play either bass, drums, guitar, keyboard, vocals. We have some violin students as well, but they have to provide their own instrument. We're not quite at the point where we provide violins. But, yeah, we teach them how to play it. We help them write a song under the direction of women like myself who are on the music scene who perform in bands, and then they perform at the end of the week in front of hundreds of screaming fans.
Yeah, talk us through a day at Girls Rock Camp.
Yeah, well, It's jam-packed. It's a lot of noise and a lot of fun. They come in. We always start out with some sort of energizers where they get to know each other. And really, you know, our mission with this camp is to empower the girls. So, like, there's always something that we talk about in the morning about, you know, backing each other up and helping to build up one another in this difficult situation of just trying to play an instrument that you just learned or creating a song with people you just met. So every morning starts out with some sort of icebreaker and empowering message. Then they go to instrument instruction, and then we usually have some sort of a recess break in the middle of the day, let them get their jitters out. Mm-hmm. And then over lunchtime, there's always a female, one of the women from camp brings their band to perform for their girls. For the girls at camp. And then after lunch, they go to band rehearsal. And then we often have some sort of a quiet time. We actually have introduced some mindfulness and meditation type stuff into the chaos and the loudness of the day. And sometimes we have little arts projects they get to do or things like writing letters to themselves. And then we sing the camp song at the end of every day like that you just heard at the beginning of the segment. Mm-hmm. And then we come back and do it again the next day.
We mentioned the empowerment side of this. Do you see, you know, from one kid at the beginning of a week to the end of the week, their confidence grow?
Absolutely. It's amazing. There's countless stories of girls who've come in, you know, with complete stage fright and then gotten up on stage on that Sunday showcase and, you know, dropped to their knees and ripped out a bass solo. I mean, it blows my mind to see the transformation in some of these kids. Now, some of them come in as complete divas and rock stars already. You know, they're like, I belong on the stage. And I love that to see those kids. But it's even more gratifying to see those kids that just blossom.
Talking to Beth Killey with Girls Rock Camp Madison about an effort to teach girls the rock and roll instruments and get them up on stage and performing. So what are those performances like, the showcases at the end of the week?
They're just amazing to me. I think I pretty much cry at every showcase because there's some kid that does something that just blows my mind. And, you know, it's really, again, about the empowerment piece. If, you know, if you can pick up an instrument on Monday and then 8 days later stand up on a stage and play it in front of a huge crowd full of people, that's a really empowering thing to see. So there's always, this next camp will have 10 bands at each camp. We usually have 9 bands, but we expanded the summer because we had so many kids on the waiting list. But 9 bands perform the song that they just wrote. And, you know, the crowd is all there, just completely behind them. It's a lot of moms and dads and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and family and friends out in the crowd. And they just shower those girls with unconditional love, and that's what it's all about.
Do you hear from the girls after camp is over that, yeah, they started at camp and they're still playing?
Yes, absolutely. I know several of them have gone on to record their own records. They're continuing to write their songs. They're performing shows. You know, Facebook is a wonderful thing. A lot of them keep up with on Facebook and see them posting their pictures of them playing and hearing about the stuff that they're doing musically. It's really, really rewarding to see that.
Are you in touch with other similar camps around the state and beyond?
Around the state, there's only one other camp in the state that I'm aware of at this time, and that's the Milwaukee camp. Mm-hmm. Although there's a gal by the name of Kelly Jackson who's starting an Indigenous Girls Rock camp this summer, which is very exciting. Every year there's a conference that takes place where, you know, people around the country who are running camps like the one we're running here in Madison get together and share ideas.
It sounds like this is a, you know, kind of a punk rock, do-it-yourself kind of thing. You
really?
Were one of a couple people who said, let's do this camp,
yes.
And you did it. So if someone else is out there in another part of the state and says, yeah, we need this too, what advice would you give them?
Give me a call. We are all about getting this to any girl who wants to participate. And, you know, they can go to girlsrockmadison.org. And see what we're doing, and we would be happy to share any wisdom that we've learned over the years to help them get this off the ground, because I think all girls deserve to rock.
Now, you're a musician for yourself. What What do you get out of this? What are you taking home from camp each summer?
Well, you know, I've kind of gotten past the point where I'm, you know, thinking I'm going to dominate the world as a musician on my own, but to leave a legacy is really important to me. And, you know, not only have I helped, you know, worked with these girls and seen what they can do and been empowered by that myself, it's really inspiring to see what they come up with. But also all the women that work for camp, we employ over 50 people over the course of the summer in many different capacities, but a lot of them are musicians themselves, and just the sisterhood that has risen up in the Madison and surrounding area and the music scene amongst the women who perform here is really incredible to see.
And Beth, I got to ask before I let you go, is there one most popular instrument that all the girls want to play, at least at the outset?
Well, a lot of them want to sing. I think maybe they're a little intimidated by picking up an instrument, but we do allow them to sample different instruments, and a lot of times they'll come back and they think a lot of them want to be drummers the next year. So drums are very popular. A lot of guitar players, a lot of keyboard players. Bass is slowly building momentum, though, too.
Well, bass is one of the best. I say, let the girls know I said bass is awesome.
I think bass has only got four strings.
It's one of those instruments I still want to learn, but I'm not very good at. Well, Beth, thank you so much for telling us about that.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Beth Kelly, music director at Girls Rock Camp Madison. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the ongoing political fight over closing Guantanamo Bay, the detention facility there, and we'll hear about a Wisconsin National Guard unit that's getting ready to deploy there. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, is out today. Coming up after 7, it's this week's edition of Reveal. With the future of race-based affirmative action up for debate, Reveal spends an hour talking about racial disparities in education. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, one of the biggest shadows hanging over the Obama administration is the continued operation of the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Throughout President Obama's candidacy and presidency, he's called for the closing of the prison, but as we reach the final months of his term in office, the facility remains open. Not that there haven't been efforts to try and close Guantanamo. A lot of plans have come and gone over the years. The latest seems to be dead in Congress, but President Obama has insisted he doesn't want to pass on the problem to the next president, whoever it is. So can it be done before that new president is sworn in? And if so, what would have to happen? We'll look at those questions and the broader issues of closing Guantanamo in just a few moments. But first, Meg Jones from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel joins us. She recently wrote about a Wisconsin National Guard unit that's getting ready to deploy to Guantanamo. Meg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So you recently reported 120 Wisconsin National Guard troops will soon be deploying to Guantanamo Bay. What can you tell us about that?
Yep, so it's the 32nd Military Police Company. It's a unit that's based out of the Milwaukee area, southeastern Wisconsin. About 60% of the unit is going to be heading to Guantanamo Bay. It's a unit of about 200 people. And it's seen a lot of action in the last couple of decades. It was deployed twice to Iraq in 03 and 04, and then again in 09 and 10. And it's my understanding that, you know, because military police companies, they're typically doing police-type activities, whether it's guarding prisoners or when they were in Iraq, they were actually mentoring the local police. So it's my understanding that they will be doing the detention things. You know, basically they'll be like sort of on a par of prison guards down at Gitmo.
And, yeah, that will be their mission there, to join the team of military prison guards in Guantanamo. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. From what I understand also, it's as there's fewer and fewer prisoners at Guantanamo, that doesn't mean there's fewer and fewer guards. There's still a fairly sizable garrison that has to be there to accommodate the prisoners, but then all of the people that are associated with down there. So these Wisconsin troops, they were notified in actually 2014 that this mission was likely to come up, so they've been preparing and training for that, and they should be leaving fairly soon. I don't know exactly when, but it'll be sometime this spring they'll be heading down to Cuba.
Meg, you've reported on Wisconsin National Guard units in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past, now Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I think a lot of people may not know that this is part of the National Guard's job listing. They actually do come up for these international or overseas, in this case, deployments a lot, don't they?
Exactly. And, you know, we really started to see a lot more of the National Guard and Reserve units being used in the early 2000s because with their two-front war in both Iraq and Afghanistan, there just was simply were not enough active duty military that that could handle what was going on over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So as a result, National Guard units like in Wisconsin started getting called up, and at first it was the units like transportation, military police, communications units that were getting called up, but then by about late 04 and 05, as the war was, especially in Iraq, was dragging on, then they started sending combat arms units, meaning infantry and artillery units. And that was the first time that that had been done where Wisconsin National Guard or any National Guard combat arms units were being sent to war zones since World War II. So the kind of the joke back in the mid-2000s was that there's only three types of Wisconsin National Guard members. Those are who are in Iraq, those are come back from Iraq, and those who are going to Iraq. So it was very common to use National Guard and Reserve units back then in the 2000s, and that's continuing on because they were also sent to Kosovo, and there's also always been a Reserve and National Guard component that's also been at Guantanamo Bay as well.
And Meg, are you going to be covering the Wisconsin unit going to Guantanamo in the future?
Well, I'll probably cover their going away ceremony. I don't know if they allow reporters to go down to Cuba and to cover them down there because it's all all detainees that are down there. But I've been covering the Wisconsin National Guard for pretty much, you know, as a regular beat since the Iraq War. So I'm sure I'll be writing some stories about them when they're down there as well.
Meg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Meg Jones, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She specializes in military and veterans issues. Now for a broader look at the issue of Guantanamo Bay, we turn to Stephen Vladek. He's a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. He's also co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, an online forum for the analysis of U.S. national security law and policy. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been hearing about this effort to close Guantanamo, both by candidate Obama, President Obama, President Bush, George W. Bush had talked about it. In short, why has this proven to be so hard to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest obstacles have been twofold. I think on the one hand, President Obama was really surprised by just how hard it was to convince other countries to take some of the detainees who we've spent so much of the last 10, 15 years labeling as terrorists. And so the diplomatic negotiations have been far more fraught than candidate Obama could ever have predicted. But also, starting in 2010, Congress has enacted these fairly onerous transfer restrictions that have made it categorically illegal for the president to move any of the detainees here into the United States, and has imposed a whole bunch of certification requirements before the president can transfer detainees to foreign countries. So added together, that's really put a trap on Guantanamo where, you know, it's only with the most, I think, careful negotiations that Obama's even going to get some of the detainees, you know, sent to third-party countries.
That said, the number of detainees has gone down over the years from three digits, you know, to 300 down to, I think, we're at about 80 now. So how have we reduced those numbers over the years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, President Obama, the population is down to exactly 80 as of today. That's one-third of the 242 that President Obama inherited from President Bush. And I think a lot of that has been because of very careful, very detailed diplomatic negotiations with other countries. You know, virtually all of the detainees who have been transferred under President Obama's watch have been sent overseas, including the most recent transfer of 9 detainees to Saudi Arabia. So, you know, there's no question that President Obama has made a lot of progress. That said, I think he would be the first to admit that he had no intention, you know, 7 full years into his presidency, of still having Guantanamo on his plate as a problem he has to deal with.
Those detainees just transferred to Saudi Arabia, I believe, were all from Yemen. And I was looking at the country of origin of the remaining detainees. That's a country that comes up again and again. Why have Yemeni detainees been such a roadblock? Why are they so hard to get out of Guantanamo?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's even more striking than even appears at first blush. I mean, of the 26 detainees who are still at Guantanamo who have been cleared for transfer, 21 are Yemeni. And part of the problem there is that whereas we've been sending most of these detainees back to their home countries, in the case of the Yemenis, you know, the Yemeni government is barely functioning. And so the U.S. government's not really confident in the ability of the Yemeni government to keep an eye on these guys to make sure that they don't just hit the ground in Yemen and go back to, you know, fighting for al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups. So because the U.S. hasn't been able to obtain those kinds of security assurances vis-a-vis the Yemenis have been the most intractable category, and it's only when another country, like Saudi Arabia, agrees to step up and take some of them that we've been able to transfer those guys from Guantanamo.
But it took a long time and a lot of negotiations, it sounds like, just to get this handful of detainees from Yemen accepted in Saudi Arabia. And I guess Saudi Arabia has some sort of de-radicalization programs that they use for their own citizens that these Yemeni detainees will be going into as well. Are we likely to send more of these detainees originally from Yemen to Saudi Arabia, or is this it?
I mean, I think we'll see a handful more of the Yemeni detainees going to Saudi Arabia, and maybe, you know, a couple here and a couple there going to other third-party countries. But, you know, there's going to come a point where that number of detainees who have been cleared for transfer gets stuck somewhere, you know, higher than zero. And I think part of the problem is diplomatic, right? All these countries are saying, why should we bear the burden of your detainee program when you're not taking any of them? And I think the hardest question for President Obama is, at the end of the day, would he accept closing Guantanamo if in exchange he had to sign on to some kind of domestic detention program where some of these detainees were brought into the United States?
And looking at some of the other detainees, not ones not cleared to be transferred, some of them are under a category. It's something like indefinite detention under the rules of war, which I think a lot of people read as we're keeping them one way or another forever for all intents and purposes. Is that right?
I mean, I think that's how it looks. And I think that's, you know, part of the difficulty of being at war with a group like al-Qaeda. I mean, during World War II, you know, we held on to some German prisoners for the better part of 10 years. We're well past that now. But, you know, the war with al-Qaeda remains ongoing. Congress considered last year proposals to maybe scale back the statutory authorization for the use of force against al-Qaeda, but really blanched at that because of the new threat posed by ISIL. So, you know, I think there's going to be some detainees who the government, and indeed President Obama's successor, is going to want to keep holding. You know, this is never going to go to zero, at least so long as the war with al-Qaeda remains ongoing. And if it's not going to go to zero, I think the real question is, do those guys stay at Guantanamo, or do we bring some of them into the U.S.?
We're talking with law professor Stephen Vladek about President Obama and his efforts to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this situation at Guantanamo Bay? Should we be closing that facility, keeping it open, as some Republican presidential candidates say, expanding it? What would a plan to close the prison look like should Congress and state governments say, yes, we'll allow detainees to be moved from Guantanamo to the mainland United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Guantanamo Bay and the detention center there and whether or not President Obama will be able to close that detention center before he leaves office. We heard earlier in the hour about a Wisconsin National Guard unit that's getting ready to deploy to Guantanamo. That got us thinking about some of the broader issues at play there. Stephen Vladek is with us. He's professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this Guantanamo Bay situation? Fewer detainees there now than before, but still some there. Do you want to see it closed? Or do we need something like this? Should it be bigger, as at least a couple of presidential candidates have said? Should these detainees be relocated into the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Brian is on the line in Minocqua. Brian, hi.
Hello.
Oh, what do you think, Brian?
Well, I was there. I was at Gitmo in 2008. I was with a public affairs unit, Wisconsin Army Guard Public Affairs Unit, and we were supported.
Oop, Brian, you still there? Brian's cutting in and out. I got a summary of his comments. He said, Stephen, he'd been there in 2008, as he said, with the National Guard, and he knew from his experience there that it wasn't going to be easy to close it. Do you think that, Stephen, that President Obama was a little too optimistic in selling his case that he'd be able to close Gitmo?
I think he probably was a little bit too optimistic, and I think part of that optimism was maybe an over understanding or a too generous understanding of how quickly our foreign partners would jump at the chance to help us. But frankly, I also think that President Obama missed an opportunity. You know, he had a Democratic Congress his first couple of years in office, and I think the government moved so slowly when it came to coming up with a process to figure out which detainees could be transferred, figuring out how to move these detainees, that by the time they really knew which ones they wanted to try to get rid of, politics had taken over, and fear about the potential for terrorist attacks after the Christmas Day bomber in 2009, I think there was an enormous lost opportunity combined with maybe a little bit of naivete on the part of President Obama.
Brian, thanks for that call. Sorry we lost you at 800-642-1234. Steve, let's talk about that perception versus reality of the risk of bringing these detainees into the United States. How much of a risk would there be to the United States, facilities maybe as a target in the U.S.?
No, I mean, it's a fair point, and there's never no risk. I think the relevant data point we have, though, is that we've tried over 500 terrorism suspects in ordinary civilian criminal courts since 9/11, including some pretty darn high-profile suspects like Zakarias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker. And these guys have been held at U.S. military prisons or U.S. civilian prisons, U.S., high-security and supermax prisons, without any attempt to free them, without any attacks on those facilities. So I don't think it's a non-concern, but I also think that if this were such a big deal, we would have seen something over the last 15 years. You know, these are the safest prisons we can build, and if they've worked so far, I'm not sure why moving some of these detainees into the U.S. would somehow make them more vulnerable.
And Steve, I wanted to ask about the legal situation of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. At best, it seems like there's a pretty big gray area. A lot of civil rights organizations nationally and internationally say this violates constitutional law, international law. Where do you see their status right now?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on, which category of detainees we're talking about. So, although there are 80 guys still at Guantanamo, they actually break down into a couple different camps. We talked earlier about the guys who are still being held potentially indefinitely under the laws of war. If we just focus on the other categories, the guys who have been cleared for release and the detainees who are being subjected to military commissions, I think there are more and more judicial decisions where courts are recognizing that they have at least some protection, where we can't just, put these guys away and forget about them. The real question, I think, is whether as time goes on, if these detainees are just languishing in Guantanamo in perpetuity, might the courts become even more aggressive in suggesting that perhaps we can't hold them forever, in suggesting that they're entitled to greater process if we're going to try to hold them for, decades on end. I think that's the elephant in the room. And ultimately, besides just the sort of moral argument that we've heard from President Obama, I think the practical concern is that if the political branches really do nothing to close Guantanamo, eventually the courts might have to.
Talking to Steve Vladek from American University about Guantanamo, efforts to close the detention facility there. We'll go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Austin is with us in Madison. Austin, hi.
Hi. I believe the question of whether to close Guantanamo Bay comes down to whether people believe in torture and whether they believe in innocent until proven guilty. Because the prisons in the United States are adequate to house people who have been given a trial and are not going to be tortured. But if we want to do those extra things, then we need a place like Guantanamo.
Austin, thanks for the call. So you're saying torture at Guantanamo and getting rid of the principle, in effect, of innocent until proven guilty. What do you make of that, Steve?
Well, I think those are two very good points, but I think we should take them separately. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things President Obama has been unquestionably successful at is ending the unlawful interrogation techniques that pervaded so much of his predecessor's administration. You know, yes, Guantanamo is still a problem. I think, yes, from some people's perspective, it's still a stain. But there's just no question that from the perspective of detainee treatment, we're doing much better now than we used to. As for the whole innocent until proven guilty, I mean, it is true historically that we have held soldiers of enemy armies without any kind of, you know, proof that they committed a crime. Just think about, you know, German soldiers during World War II, you know, Confederate soldiers during the Civil War. I think the real question is not, is there any legal authority to hold prisoners in that context? The real question is there enough process to make sure that these guys are who the government says they are, and that the legal authorities the government is relying upon are being invoked properly? And that's what so much of the fight has been about. That's why the Supreme Court's 2008 ruling that the Guantanamo detainees were entitled to habeas corpus was such an important moment in this story. There are still 80 guys there. You know, some of those will never get a day in court, and that's something we should all be worried about. But at the very least, they've had some process and some opportunity to show that they're not who the government says they are. You know, reasonable folks can disagree about whether that process was sufficient, but I think there's at least, you know, some support that at least some of those guys are lawfully detained.
We've talked about some legal issues, practical issues, political issues surrounding Guantanamo. How about the symbolic issues? How big does Guantanamo loom as a symbol in our international relations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where Austin was really onto something in his question. I mean, I think the torture issue, even though it's no longer a ongoing concern, is part of why Guantanamo as a symbol is such a black mark for President Obama and something he wants so desperately to close, even if he doesn't want to end the actual policy. And so I think that's why, from President Obama's perspective, there's a real imperative to get this done on his watch, not because he thinks the policy should be ended, but because he wants to be responsible for the complete repudiation of the tactics and of the abuses and the mistreatment. And maybe what's going to happen is, you know, he won't get a Congress that's willing to work with him until after the presidential election, and then a lame duck Congress might actually be willing to work with a lame duck president if they think they'll get a better deal from President Obama than, for example, from a President Clinton.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Vladek. He's professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law and co-editor-in-chief of the online forum Just Security. He joins to talk about Guantanamo Bay's detention center. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.